This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll give an update in the case of Mohamed Salah.
Remember that case? The man was tortured by Israeli intelligence for 5 years. They bring him to trial here, and he's convicted of a minor crime, but sentenced nonetheless.
We'll talk with constitutional lawyer David Cole about his latest article in the New York Review of Books.
Ashcroft and Gonzalez, two wings of the same bird. Those are some attorney generals we have.
We're joined by incredible Peter Weiss, an attorney who's kicking off our new series, Lawyers You'll Like.
Peter has won some of the most important human rights cases in the United States and around the world in the last 40 years. From stopping torture to stopping nuclear weapons, it's an extraordinary legal career.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Here on Law and Disorder, we followed the pivotal moments in the Mohamed Salah case. Earlier this year, Mr. Salah was cleared of terrorism charges. Recently, however, he was convicted of lesser charges related to filling out a legal questionnaire in an unrelated civil suit. He faces nearly 2 years in prison. The sentence for a minor charge of obstruction of justice comes as a major setback for prosecutors who have spent a decade investigating charges that could have put him behind bars for life. With us today to give us an update in this case is Michael Deutsch, Mohamed Salah's attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago.
Michael, congratulations on all the hard work you did to finally get to this point. Although, for all of us, it was really sad to see the guy have to do even 1 hour in prison.
Agree.
My nephew Ben, who works at the People's Law Office with you, has been keeping me up to date on this case. And Ben told me that the courtroom was overflowing when you gave your presentation to the judge on sentencing Mohamed Salah. The overflow courtroom was also overflowing, and he said there were a lot of tears, a lot of undry eyes in both those rooms, especially amongst the Arab men when you were talking, and that there was this huge amount of community upsurge and support here. And I wanted you to give us a little flavor for what it was like that day when you were speaking to the judge in that crowded courtroom, pleading to keep this man from being taken from his family yet again, because he served 5 years under the Israelis, taken from his family yet again for the, quote, crime of putting what was called a false answer on a civil interrogatory.
Yeah, it was a very moving experience. I mean, I was literally on the verge of tears throughout about an hour presentation. And really what moved me, and I think moved anybody, that were the letters. He had over 650 letters, mostly from community people who had known him and worked with him, from young people who he had tutored and mentored over the years, from people who he had helped at the mosque, that he had been a teacher, that he had set up private schools to teach and tutor kids in math and Arabic and in the Muslim religion. And, of course, there were the other people from the Jewish community that wrote letters, and law professors and doctors and ministers and community organizers. It was amazing to me, in all my history of doing cases like this, I had never seen the types of letters, the outpouring of support that came from the community in his behalf. And this is not something that was done, you know, after he was charged, you know, that he started to get religion or started to get active in the community. This was literally for 35 years, from the day he arrived in this country as a stateless refugee, penniless. He began to serve his community and help the young people and teach the young people. And even the letters from his children were so moving. You know, one, his oldest son said, my father's my best friend, that I had to grow up without my father for 5 years. His daughter, who's a teenager, one letter said from one of her friends, she's the only girl I know that would rather spend time with her dad than hang out with her friends. So it was moving, and it was so unjust to put this man back in prison, to even prosecute this man, and to have him convicted of this charge, which is such a phony charge of not fully answering interrogatories in a civil case, which resulted from a case brought by the Israeli lobby against Muslim-Palestinian organizations as in a tort case, in which he did answer a lot of the questions, which he provided documents for the plaintiffs in the case, and yet through some process the jury found him guilty of not answering all the questions truthfully. And yeah, there were a lot of people in tears as a result of, you know, what Mohammed's life has been about, and the idea that he would have to go back to prison now for one day or one month as a result of this type of politically motivated prosecution.
You know, I do tort litigation. Less than candid answers, often suggested by the attorneys, are run of the mill, and nothing like this ever happens.
It happens every day. Yeah, we know that. We know anyone that does civil litigation knows that nobody fully answers interrogatories, that everybody hedges, and that ultimately you take a deposition if you want the information. The interesting thing is that these lawyers never moved to compel answers. There were all these constitutional challenges to the interrogatories. For example, one interrogatory said, name every event that you've gone to in the last 5 years that dealt with Palestinian issues, and give us the names of everyone who was at the event. Now, if that is not an overbroad interrogatory that violates the First Amendment,
that's the definition of one. But let's back up for a second, because you did get an acquittal on the main charge.
Yes.
And this was one of Ashcroft's showcase trials.
Right.
This was one that he trumpeted. And criminal trials that the government brings are usually won more than 9 out of 10. What are the statistics? 92%? Yet under Ashcroft, I think these fake terrorism trials that he used to scare the Republic, I think he won only 29% of them. And one of the big losses that he was hit with was this. Let's give the listeners a little perspective on this, because it was a major victory, really, despite the tragedy of his being torn from his family again. Give the listeners just a little, in a nutshell, history of the prosecution that Ashcroft lost, and then let's go into some more of the details. But please first, you know, share with us that history.
Well, he was charged with along with Dr. Abul Halim Ashgar with being a member of a RICO, Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organization conspiracy, which was Hamas. And they basically said that he was a part of the conspiracy, which was Hamas, to fund and support the resistance, the military resistance to the occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. And that he himself had been arrested in January of 93, and literally tortured, interrogated for 54 days, denied access to a lawyer, subjected to all the systematic ways that the Shin Bet, that's the Israeli secret police, get information, tied to a small chair, deprived of sleep for long periods of time, threatened, slapped, isolated, put in small closet cells. And as a result of that, they came up with a statement that he made, which was put secretly taped, 5 hours of tape, in which he literally conceded in this statement that he was involved in helping the resistance to the occupation. The FBI put an informant next to him. This informant was even at the airport as part of the greeting group that greeted him when he came home. And this informant was with him almost on a daily basis for 4 years and reported on him continually with the FBI. There's over 1,000 interviews that the informant gave to the FBI. Plus, the informant wore a wire, and his phone, Salah's phone, was wiretapped, and his office, his business was wiretapped. And they didn't have anything that was in any way criminal conduct through this informant. And in fact, the FBI had been told that this informant was unreliable. Don't use him unless you have independent corroboration. And on the eve of trial, they actually dismissed the count in which was the basis for the informant's information. Because when they had the press conference, when the indictment came down and Ashcroft came here, and they had all this hoopla, they said that Salah had sent an associate to the occupied territories to scout bombing sites. And this was based on the informant. And when it came time to deliver, they just dismissed the count and dismissed any mention of the informant. And then, lo and behold, after the trial was over, a couple of months after the trial was over, the informant is arrested for impersonating an FBI agent in the Muslim community and trying to coerce hundreds of thousands of dollars from members of the Muslim community while armed with a gun.
That's a beautiful story. That's the kind of people they use.
Yeah.
You know, it's really an outrage, Michael. You know, when you and I were younger practicing law, the government couldn't appeal sentences really except in the most, you know, I don't think they ever could, actually.
I don't think they could either.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it makes it, here's what's happened. You get a sentence that, well, not a good sentence, the government doesn't like. And while you may have good issues in your underlying case, you can't go up because the government has this sword over your head saying, you go up, we're going to ask this very conservative circuit for a higher sentence. It's basically denying your right to appeal the errors that were made at the trial.
Absolutely. And it's the same principle when you can't file a motion to suppress, because if you lose the motion, they're going to punish you for that because they're going to say you lied in your affidavit. So it's all part of this whole piece of limiting the rights of people who are on trial and, you know, making it much more difficult to get justice in these courts.
Well, you clawed out a huge measure of justice, Michael Deutsch. In your work for Mohamed Salah, you're an example, really, for all the young people that listen to this show, people who want to be movement attorneys. We can't tell you how much we respect you for what you did, and we thank you for being on Law and Disorder once again.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Bye, Michael.
Take care.
In his latest article in the New York Review of Books, our next guest, David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University, reviews several books, including John Ashcroft's Never Again, Securing America and Restoring Justice, General Ashcroft, Attorney at War, by Nancy V. Baker, and It Can Happen Here, Authoritarian Peril in the Age of Bush, by Joe Connison, and also Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror, by Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr., and Aziz Z. Huck. These publications create an outline of how former Attorney General John Ashcroft helped create a platform that allowed the Bush administration to torture, allow coerced confessions, and hold defendants indefinitely without trial.
Okay, David, we want to welcome you to Law and Disorder. Just to inform our listeners, as the New York Times always does when there's a conflict of interest, David and I are very close friends. He worked at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's on the board of the center. And, of course, he's a professor at Georgetown University as well. And we're going to talk to David today about the article called Grand Inquisitors, which recently came out in the New York Review of Books. And really what David does is look at four books that more or less concern post 9/11 civil liberties, but focus a lot on John Ashcroft. So today, welcome to Law and Disorder, David.
Thanks for having me.
I don't know where to begin with this, but let's start with John Ashcroft. What's your take on Ashcroft's book and his tenure as our Attorney General, and if you can remind us when he was Attorney General?
He was, of course, the Attorney General for Bush's first term. So he was the Attorney General on 9/11, and he has since stepped down, and Gonzalez took his place. And Ashcroft, upon stepping down, wrote a memoir of his time in office, which was called, without irony, Never Again, you wonder whether it's a promise that we'll never see John Ashcroft again, but I don't think that's what he meant by it.
What do you think he means by that? That we're never going to have to face a 9/11 again?
Or? Yeah. It's, you know, his job as Attorney General after 9/11 was to ensure that never again would the United States suffer an attack of that nature. And, of course, you know, we all hope that never again will the United States suffer an attack of that nature. But the approach that he took to ensuring that this would happen never again was, in his terms, the paradigm of prevention, a kind of sweeping approach that says, let's round up the usual suspects, whether or not we have very good evidence to indicate that they're going to engage in terrorist activity, and maybe if we sweep up enough people, we will net some terrorists, we will stop some terrorist attack from occurring. And I think that he put that in place on the domestic level through the immigration law, the material witness power, and the like, and ultimately ended up sweeping up many, many thousands of people, most of them non-citizens.
I think you mentioned the number 5,000 in your article.
Yeah.
And when you mentioned that, you also give us a number as to how many of those people were convicted of terrorism. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, in the first 2 years after 9/11, the federal government has admitted to detaining more than 5,000 foreign nationals in anti-terrorism initiatives. And of those 5,000, today, zero. None stand convicted of a terrorist offense. They also put in place a special registration program that called in 80,000 people simply because they were foreign nationals from Arab and Muslim countries, where they had to come in, be registered, fingerprinted, photographed, interviewed, and zero, exactly none of them have been convicted of a terrorist offense. And they sent the FBI out to interview 8,000 young men, again, simply because they came from Arab and Muslim countries, and none of them have turned out to be terrorists. So the government's record is zero for 93,000.
You have another amazing statistic in here, David, that I know you're coming out with a book also with Jules Lobel, which we'll interview you on, called, I think it's, is it Less Safe and Less Free?
Right.
But the statistic you have is, I would call it the 29% statistic. Yeah. Why don't you tell our listeners what that means? Yeah.
The government's success rate in terror prosecutions. And one of the other things that John Ashcroft did was hold many, many press conferences announcing the latest indictment of the latest terror cell. He would, you know, each time say that this is, you know, it shows that we're keeping America safe, that we're capturing the terrorists, that we're bringing them to justice. What he didn't do is hold a news conference when the cases fell apart. And the vast majority of them did fall apart, so that the government's success rate since 9/11 in terrorism prosecutions is 29%, which is a really low figure. And when you compare it to the government's success rate, the U.S. government's success rate in federal felony prosecutions generally, so all felony prosecutions, their success rate is 93%. They basically don't lose. And yet, in the terrorism context, they lose far more often than they win. And you'd think it'd be the other way around, given the fear of terrorism, given the prejudice against Arab and Muslims who are alleged to be terrorists. You'd think it'd be a cakewalk to convict someone in the terrorism case. And yet they're losing far more often than they're winning. And I think what that shows is, again, one of the costs of this preventive paradigm. They are bringing cases before they have good evidence, before in situations where they fear that somebody might do something in the future, but they don't have the evidence that they can hold the person accountable for doing something wrong in the past, and so they result in acquittals. And, you know, an acquittal doesn't protect us in the long term, and may well have put a wholly innocent person through hell.
Yeah, well, that doesn't seem to bother Ashcroft so much.
He never
apologized. You know, but you tell a story in this article that I hope you can relate to our listeners, David, and that's about Ashcroft growing up with a Pentecostal minister for a father, and the father Well, you tell the story. Every time Ashcroft assumed another governmental position, the father would exercise this right. Tell the whole story for our listeners, because I think it makes a point.
You know, actually, my proposed title for this piece was The Fundamentalist and the Facilitator. John Ash, fundamentalist, Alberto Gonzalez being the facilitator. And that's really my take on it. I don't think it fit on the page, so they went with the Grand Inquisitors. But John Ashcroft is not coincidental that he is a fundamentalist Christian. He went through this bizarre rite every time he assumed any public office in which his father would anoint him with oil on his forehead, a rite that goes back to the kings
in Israel.
From the
Bible.
Yeah,
it was David and Saul and Samuel. Yeah. I remember that when I was a kid. That's where I learned the word. What's the word for oily that he used?
Ashcroft is oily.
Right. When he became Attorney General of the United States, his father had passed away, so he needed to find somebody else to do this anointment with oils, and it was Clarence Thomas. You know, there's nothing wrong with being religious and being and praying, of course, but I think what John Ashcroft's fundamentalism, the way it played out in his public life, was he divides the world into sharp black and white, good and evil. And if you are not on the side of good, you are evil. So he demonized his critics, whether they be Democrats or civil liberties and civil rights groups or even librarians, because you were either with us or against us. That was his approach to the world. And I think in the post 9/11 context, where there are very difficult questions about how you appropriately balance security and liberty, that kind of approach, blunderbuss approach, black and white approach, I think disserved us.
I take it that Professor Cole at Georgetown Law School would give him an F. But what grade would you give his successor, Alberto Gonzalez? How would you compare and contrast the styles of the two men?
Ashcroft never apologized. You know, even when it came out that the people rounded up after 9/11, none of them turned out to be terrorists and many of them were abused, his initial response, his first response and only response was, I make no apologies. Gonzalez, by contrast, a much more polite man, a much more soft-spoken man, willing to admit to nuance, willing to admit that issues are difficult, willing to admit that mistakes were made, even though he can't remember exactly what mistakes were made. But he is, you know, if you look at his sort of resume in the war on terror, in many ways he is worse than Ashcroft, because, you know, it's his signature that leads to the position that the Geneva Conventions don't apply to detainees.
He called him quaint and outmoded.
Yeah, it's his signature that says that the prohibition on cruel and human and degrading treatment, an international prohibition that we were central in getting adopted and which we ratified, somehow doesn't apply to foreign nationals held outside the United States.
You know, David, interesting on those positions, and I want to hear the rest of them, but I guess you and I both probably have read the Washington Post series on
Cheney,
and they talk about that particularly the first memo you mentioned, I think, about the Geneva Conventions not applying for reasons of having to do, you know, certain kinds of interrogations. And they mentioned that it was actually drafted, I think, we're out of Cheney's office, and Gonzalez simply signed it. I think that's the memo they're referring to. Do you recall?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, I think that's consistent with the sense that he's not the mover and shaker. You know, I mean, he's not the moving force. I think Cheney's the moving force. John Yoo was much more of a moving force. But he was the person with the final say in advising George Bush, and he's the person who sort of signs off on these things for the president to say yes, go ahead and do them, and every time he does exactly that. And there have been accounts, including the most recent Washington Post account, but also there was several years ago a New York Times account, which indicated that Gonzalez really ran the meetings that led to the development of these of policies on things like torture and the Geneva Conventions. And when anyone gave a glimmer of concern or opposition, they were then just not invited back to the room, so that the table, through Gonzalez's actions, the table became composed solely of people who agreed with the kind of Cheney view of the world and of the law, and it's a that's a disastrous view, and a view that has, I think, been disastrous for the United States in the war on terror.
David, there was that famous story where Gonzalez actually comes face to face with Ashcroft in the hospital, and I wonder whether you'd relate that, because I think it's significant. If you'd relate that for our listeners,
yeah. Well, that story has of course most famously been told by James Comey, who was the Deputy Attorney General under Bush and under Ashcroft, and at a particular time, and is a Republican, is former U.S. attorney in New York and a prosecutor of a number of high-level terrorism cases. You know, no faint-hearted liberal. But he oversaw a review of the NSA warrantless wiretapping program in 2004. The program had been going on for several years. Prior to that, had been approved and certified by the Justice Department repeatedly. But Comey oversaw a review of the legal underpinnings of that program and concluded that it was illegal and could not be certified as legal. And he discussed that with John Ashcroft, who agreed with him. And that afternoon, Ashcroft fell ill, had to go into the hospital for emergency, I think it was gallbladder surgery. And so James Comey became the acting attorney general, because whenever the attorney general has to go into the hospital, there's an automatic shift of power to the number two person. He was under sedation, Ashcroft. So Comey then tells Gonzalez and the White House, Gonzalez is now White House counsel, that the attorney general is not going to sign off on the NSA program. And Gonzalez's response is, along with Andrew Card, White House chief of staff, to rush to the hospital where John Ashcroft is under sedation, recovering from his surgery, to get him to somehow overrule Comey. Even though Comey and Ashcroft had agreed beforehand that this was not to be approved, and even though Comey was the attorney general at the time, not Ashcroft, because Ashcroft was under sedation. He rushes to the hospital. Comey learns from Ashcroft's wife that Gonzalez is going to the hospital. And so he rushes to the hospital as well. He gets there first. He talks to the attorney general. The attorney general is very dazed and confused. I don't think those are the words he used. Essentially dazed and confused. He talks to the attorney general for a few minutes. Gonzalez and Card come. They hand this piece of paper to Ashcroft, trying to get him to essentially sign it. And Ashcroft sits up, says, no, you know, we've decided that we're not going to authorize this thing. And by the way, it doesn't matter what I think, because he's the attorney general, pointing to Comey. It's really a stunning moment, because here you had the White House counsel essentially doing an end run around the attorney general, going to someone who's not the attorney general and trying to get that person in his sedated state to approve of an illegal program. And, you know, many people have credited, I mean, I think it says a lot about Alberto Gonzalez that he would go to this length to get a yes for his boss. Some people have said, you know, you got to give credit to John Ashcroft. At least he stood up against the president on this one occasion. I think that's a bit, you know, premature. You give him some credit, but you have to remember, Ashcroft repeatedly approved of the NSA warrantless wiretapping program before this one period when they determined that they thought it was illegal, and he repeatedly approved of it after that as well. So it wasn't at one moment in time he did stand up to the president, but that may be the only moment.
David, we've had this program, Law and Disorder, now for about 3 years, and with increasing dismay, we see various laws coming out, siding with the Patriot Act, and the last horrendous one was the Military Commission Act of 2006. And even though it seems like the Bush people, Ashcroft and Gonzalez and all the rest of them, may be in their waning days, nonetheless, they've left us with these structural deformities that really threaten any kind of constitutional democracy. So even if the individuals are changed over the next couple of years, what's your feeling for where we're at and what we should do about it?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, this administration and the prior Congress have dug us into a very, very deep hole. And, you know, it's both with respect to the legal situation in terms of laws passed here, but I think more so in terms of the United States' reputation abroad and the anti-Americanism that has never been higher in our history. And, you know, what we need to do is we need to begin to reverse that. I think it's going to be incredibly difficult to do, but I think if we have a new administration, there will be a certain amount of giving them the benefit of the doubt. But I think that that administration is going to need to take some bold steps to say, we, the United States, want to reestablish our position as a leader in human rights and the rule of law, rather than one of the leading violators of the rule of law and human rights. And so I think we need to close Guantanamo. We need to agree to abide by the Geneva Conventions. I think we would be suited to agree to be bound by the Inter-American Court on Human Rights with respect to the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights. I think we need to be able to say to the world, we are willing to be judged by others. We are willing to abide by the basic rules that everybody else has to abide by. And until we send that message to the rest of the world, I think that we're going to continue to face the kind of anti-Americanism that plays directly into the hands of Al-Qaeda and others who would do us harm.
Well, thank you very much, David Cole, for being with us today on Law and Disorder. Again, we're speaking with David Cole, author of a recent article in the New York Review of Books on Ashcroft and Gonzalez called Grand Inquisitors. And David, in within a month or so, will have a new book called Less Safe and Less Free. So thank you again, David.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks, David.
Bye, bye-bye. David.
Most of you listeners know, the four hosts of the show are all lawyers, and we like to advertise ourselves as lawyers you'll like. Well, as part of our next and continuing series, we want to interview lawyers who have been not necessarily well-known, but who have done really significant things with their lives as progressive lawyers. One of those lawyers is Peter Weiss. He's the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He was a refugee from the Holocaust in Europe. He's had an extraordinary career, but an extraordinary career particularly in the idea that human rights are rights that can be enforced and that belong to all of us and that are worldwide rights. He's won some important cases, suing against torturers in the United States, suing to stop nuclear weapons all over the world. A really amazing career. Today we're glad to bring to you a short interview with Peter Weiss, again, one of the more important lawyers still practicing today. Short interview.
Off our series on lawyers you'll like with you, Peter, probably the most popular lawyer in the room. We wanted to give our listeners a little idea of your background. You've been practicing law for quite a long time. I know that you came with your mother from Europe with the bad guys in hot pursuit. Can you tell us a little bit about your background before we start talking about the significant cases that you've been involved in?
Yeah, I was born in Vienna. And when the Nazis came in 1938, my parents decided to go to France. I lived there for 2.5 years and then came here in 1941. Went to what was then called Straubmuller Textile High School, now called Charles Evans Hughes, because my parents decided that the first Jews to be killed were going to be the intellectuals, so they wanted me to have a trade.
What and was the trade?
The trade was textile.
Oh, it was a textile school.
Yeah, I took a course in weaving.
Amazing.
Power weaving. I got a scholarship from the Ethical Culture Society to go to St. John's College in Annapolis, also known as the Great Books College. And after 2 years there, I was drafted into the Army. Eventually wound up in military intelligence because of my languages, mostly German. And then I spent a year after I was demobilized in 1946, I spent a year in Germany working for U.S. military government in its decartelization branch, which was supposed to break up the German cartels. And that didn't last very long because somebody in Washington decided they needed the cartels to fight the commies.
By cartels, we mean big corporations like Krupp and Bayer Aspirin or whatever they are.
IG Farben. IG Farben, so forth. Right. But it was a very exciting time, and it got me interested in the law. Then I went back and finished St. John's. At the end of that two-year period, I applied to a bunch of law schools saying that I wanted to work for what was then going to be the International Trade Organization based in Havana, Cuba, which was...
This is before the revolution, right?
Oh, yeah, long before, 1949. That was supposed to break up the cartels worldwide, and... The admissions people at Yale seemed to like that, so I got into Yale Law School. But never did anything about antitrust again after that.
And then I know you became a trademark lawyer, which was your specialty, right? An intellectual property, really. Right. But I first knew you, this is Michael Ratner speaking, I first knew you when I went to the center in 71. You were already there at the center. So there must have been some history around then. But of course, I remember you best because at that time, none of us knew anything about international law. And I always tell the story. Peter insisted that we put international law claims into every single piece of litigation we did. So how did you get from Yale to international law and the importance really of human rights in international law?
Well, actually, I took an international law course at Yale with one of the great international lawyers of that time, Myers McDougall, former president of the American Society of International Law, who has produced a number of quite progressive international lawyers like Burns Weston and Richard Falk, but also some conservative ones. But that got me interested in international law, plus my multinational background, having lived in France and been born in Austria. I somehow, for some reason, I believed in international law.
Now, I know you have, I don't know whether to go to the highlights of some of the cases you've done, but they were all highlights in terms of an end goal. So why don't we start with what then was your end goal in terms of international law?
At that time, you guys are all too young to remember that, but the end of the war was a very... progressive period in terms of people's expectations. People thought that was the last big war, and now we were going on to build a peaceful, just world. Some people talked about world government. I actually worked for a few months for a foundation for world government. Others just thought this was going to be the period in history when poverty was going to be done away with. There was a great deal of interest in economic development then. I actually spent my first 2 years after graduating from Yale in 1952 running an organization called the IDPA, the International Development Placement Association, which was a precursor of the Peace Corps. And then at the end of those 2 years, I had to start making a living because the Internal Revenue Service decided that sending young Americans to work in what were then called underdeveloped countries was not something entitled to tax exemption. So IDPA had to go out of business, and I had to go and practice law.
So tell us a little bit about when you look at your legal career. I mean, what you consider some of the most, I know some of them, but I don't want to say what I consider them. So some of your most significant either litigations or work.
Well, I think there were probably two. One was the the Filatiga case that I did with the center, with my colleagues, Rhonda Copeland principally, and John Corwin, which brought the Alien Tort Claims Act back to life in 1978. And the other one was a case that I worked on in the 90s at the International Court of Justice, obtaining an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice on the illegality of nuclear weapons.
Let's go to the first one, Filatiga v. Peñarella, which is the Alien Tort Claim Statute. I remember, I being at the center at the time, this was a case in which there was a torture committed in Paraguay against a young man who was killed eventually, and his family happened to come to the United States, and the man who engaged the torture eventually came into the United States. That's
right.
Peñarella.
Right.
And you decided that somehow, even though everything happened in Paraguay, that the United States could actually do something in this case. Now, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the reason we thought that was because almost 10 years before that, we discovered a very old law going back to the First Judiciary Act of 1789, which in one sentence said that an alien has a right of action in an American court for a tort in violation of the law of nations, which is what they called international law in the 18th century. And the reason we discovered that at the time of my lie is because we were in touch with a then little-known journalist called Seymour Hersh, who got the Pulitzer Prize for exposing the massacre at My Lai in Vietnam.
Well, we're really glad, Peter, to have you with us. Peter Weiss, who is now the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who was there when I started in the early 70s. And we're talking with Peter about the case called Filatiga v. Peñarella, which was a torture that occurred in Paraguay. And Peter was giving us some of really the genesis of that case, which is probably the most important human rights case ever brought in the United States, and what the significance is. But first tell us how we won it, Peter, at the center, or how you and Rhonda and Corwin won it.
Well, we lost it in the first instance, even though we had a sympathetic judge. We had Judge Eugene Nickerson in the Eastern District, who used to march with us in the anti-Vietnam marches. When we brought the case to him, made it quite clear that he would have liked to rule for us, but he considered himself bound by a precedent in the Second Circuit. And so then eventually we won it on appeal in the Second Circuit. It has now been held up in 5 or 6 other circuits and in the Supreme Court.
Let's talk about that circuit for a second because it was extraordinary. What you were saying here is that a person who was tortured in Paraguay, a Paraguayan national, tortured by a Paraguayan police official, that the family of the man who was tortured and killed could bring a suit in the United States. And that's pretty extraordinary.
Yes.
Because I know you're a big person in international law. What was so important to you about that?
It was the fact that not only the courts, but also the State Department. Remember, this was under Jimmy Carter. When I got up to argue that case before the Second Circuit, Judge Kaufman of Rosenberg fame interrupted me after the first 2 or 3 sentences and said, Mr. Weiss, what does the State Department think of this case? And I said to myself very quietly, what's going on here? You know, I mean, I was taught in law school that we're supposed to have an independent judiciary here. But what I said to the judge was, well, there are people in the State Department who like this case, and there are people in the State Department who don't like it. But I don't think it should matter what people in the State Department think, because you're the judge. Now, as it happened, one of the people who eventually wrote the State Department position on this, which Judge Kaufman requested about 5 minutes after the hearing was over, he told his clerk to write to the State Department and ask for a State Department position. And one of the people to whom this came was a wonderful man named Charles Runyon, who used to be the assistant dean at Yale when I was there, and a great proponent of human rights. And that was the brief period, you know, when human rights were really being taken seriously by the State Department. So the brief that the State Department submitted supported the case. And I'm convinced that had it been the other way, we would have lost the case. So well, we didn't really win it before Judge Kaufman. We won it in the State Department.
I think that's a really important point. And, of course, the period was, again, Jimmy Carter's presidency, 76 to 80. It was right after the Vietnam War. It was a president who at least espoused human rights, and it was a special period, I think, in our American history. Now, Judge Kaufman did have some ringing language in that opinion, which you might want to tell our listeners.
Well, the ringing language he got out of our briefs.
And what is it, Pete? What?
The ringing language was, with this decision, the torturer, like the pirate of old, has become hostis humani generis, the enemy of all mankind. We lifted it from somewhere, and he lifted it out of our brief.
Now, I think there's a couple of ways to go here. That was, as you said, it was a big victory. And, of course, when we look at even the center's current work on the Rumsfeld case and the Pinochet case and bringing international human rights violators to justice, this case is really the cornerstone. And it's also the cornerstone for a lot of other work in the alien tort claims area. And why don't you just give us some overview of that work, and then we'll go on to your next big legal precedent.
Well, it's the beginning of a development in international law which may well turn out to be the most important development of this century in international law. And that is something called universal jurisdiction. And precisely the fact that some crimes are so heinous that they should be subject to trial in any country in the world. Now, we haven't quite gotten there yet, but we do have the Alien Tort Statute in the United States. We have the International Criminal Court. And we have an increasing number of countries which have enacted legislation to implement the principle of universal jurisdiction. And it's, for instance, under the German universal jurisdiction law, which says that a war crime against humanity, aggression, or genocide can be prosecuted by the German prosecutor regardless of where it happens and regardless of where the perpetrator is located. Unfortunately, almost 60 cases have been brought on that so far in Germany, and not a single one has been followed up by the prosecutor. So that's a wonderful example of the hypocrisy of legislators and prosecutors.
And, of course, Peter and I in the Center for Constitutional Rights are co-counsel in the Rumsfeld case in Germany, which was recently dismissed, but again, on the universal jurisdiction basis is what we brought.
Yes, and I think we should mention, because we need a laugh here, I think we should mention the ground on which the case was dismissed both times.
You're making me laugh already because I know what right. You're going to say.
The official ground of the prosecutor was that there was no reason to believe that Rumsfeld wouldn't be prosecuted in the United States.
So all our listeners can just take a good laugh at that, because that's not going to happen while we're around. Anyway, so Peter, that I know is one of the many significant events in your career, and it's a short interview. But the other area is...
Well, we wanted to talk to you about your work on trying to stop nuclear proliferation. We know you're the president of an organization that's trying to bring about that through law, and that you've been active in that for many decades.
The first thing to do about it is to get away from the word non-proliferation, because non-proliferation in the non-proliferation treaty is another word for nuclear apartheid. In other words, the five official nuclear weapons states, which interestingly also happen to be the five states that have the veto in the Security Council, the U.S., France, the U.K., Russia, and China, want to hold on to their nuclear weapons, and they don't want anybody else to have them, right? We got them, you can't get them. That's their view of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That is a total violation of the treaty itself, which one of my colleagues in this area always says, whenever you talk about it, you have to call it the Treaty for Non-Proliferation and for Total Nuclear Disarmament, because that's what it was intended to be, because Article 6 of the treaty says, here's the deal. You guys, the rest of the world, stay away from nuclear weapons, and we who have them will negotiate in good faith to get rid of them. That second part has been buried. And back in 1995, my colleagues in this country and in many other countries, because I used to be at that time president of the International Association for Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms, which has chapters in quite a few countries. And we lobbied the General Assembly of the United Nations to put a question to the International Court of Justice, which is the highest tribunal for questions of international law in the world. And the question basically was, is the threat or use of nuclear weapons legal or illegal under international law? And that was based on the fact that international law prohibits many of the characteristics of nuclear weapons, the principal one being that there is no way to limit that weapon to what weapons are supposed to do, namely kill soldiers. And there's no way to discriminate between soldiers and civilians if a nuclear weapon is ever used. And there are other things like violations of neutrality and so forth. And we got a majority of the General Assembly to put the question to the International Court. We had 3 weeks of hearings before the International Court of Justice in The Hague, where we were in touch with various governments that submitted briefs or argued in person before the court. It was the case which involved a greater number of countries participating than any previous case in the history of the International Court of Justice and its predecessor, the Permanent Court of International Arbitration, since 1922. And, one interesting aspect of it was that countries testify or argue before the court in alphabetical order. And so the last two countries, it seemed, when we were there to argue, were going to be the United States and the UK. And knowing that judges are frequently influenced by the last presentations made to them, we had to do something. So what do? We got Zimbabwe. And we stayed up all night with the local representative, and Zimbabwe made a beautiful presentation to the court. So it was about 9 months later that they came out with a ruling saying, in effect, the threat and use of nuclear weapons is generally illegal under international law. And then they did something remarkable. The last sentence in this very long decision answered a question that we hadn't even put to them. And they said, there is a general obligation, meaning an obligation binding on all countries in the world, to negotiate in good faith and pursue to a conclusion a treaty providing for the elimination of all nuclear weapons. And the words in good faith are in there, taken from Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So at this point, we in the anti-nuclear legal community, or the anti-nuclear activist community, are considering going back to the court and, with the help again of the General Assembly, asking a new question. When the highest tribunal in the world dealing with international law questions has said that there is a general obligation to do something in good faith, how long can countries wait to implement that? Because it's been 11 years now.
So, Peter, you've had a long, amazing career, won some really important cases. How do you look at the future? I mean, you know, I would say from our position at the center and from yours, you know, there's some bleak things that have happened certainly in this last period. How do you keep going? What makes you...
If you've been associated with the Center for Constitutional Rights as long as I have been, which is since 1969, you have to have faith in the future, because otherwise we'd be wasting our time,
it's
right?
It's true. It's true, Peter.
So things are pretty bleak. We've just had three bad 5-4 decisions from the Supreme Court 2 days ago. But as long as there are places like the Center and people like the lawyers who work at the Center and in other organizations that do Guantanamo work and human rights work and so forth, I take a long view. And I think at some point human rights will become the... I'm going to interrupt myself here and quote Justice Marshall. Justice Thurgood Marshall of the Supreme Court said in a speech he gave that the law is the glue that holds society together. And I think human rights will become the architecture of society. So you need the full implementation of human rights, all human rights for all people, as it says in the United Nations. But you also need lawyers who bring the kind of cases that we've been bringing at the Center, and you need judges who have the courage to deal with them.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Peter Weiss, Vice President of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and this is Michael Ratner. And Peter, I just want to, you know, I've been really working with you since 71 when I came to the Center, and it's been just one of the, you know, the great pleasures and learning experiences of my life. So thank you for everything, Peter.
Thank you for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.